Okay, we'll bring to order the Committee on Crime Prevention and Public Safety Policy and Finance, and we'll start out with a roll call.
Chair Cornish?
Here.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine? Representative Dean? Representative Hertas?
Here.
Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe?
Here.
Representative Lohmer?
Here.
Representative Lucero? Representative Neuberger? Representative O'Neill? Representative Quam?
Present.
Representative Rosenthal?
Here.
Representative Schoen? Representative Ward? Representative Winkler? And Representative Zerwas?
Here.
I'm here too.
Okay, looks like we've got a quorum present. We'll bring the meeting to order and entertain a motion to approve the minutes from January 28th. Representative Considine.
Actually, we don't have the minutes yet, so I can't.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you don't? In your packet? Who's got the minutes? Somebody open up and take a quick look. Got to make this official. All right. Representative Lohmer moves the minutes of January 28th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, motion carried. Members, today our agenda is going to go like this. I'm going to have House File 12. I'll present first, and Representative Johnson, the Vice Chair, will take the chair while I'm doing that. After that, we'll review the spreadsheet of the Governor's budget recommendations, and then the Judicial Branch will give us a budget presentation. So, Representative Johnson, you take the bring your nameplate with you there. Shut this off. If you folks got a cell phone, sometimes it helps if you put them in your pockets. If you leave them laying too close to your microphone, they'll get that sound when you get a text or a call. Either that or just maybe shut them off.
Representative Cornish, you wish to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members, I'd like to move House File 12 to be recommended to pass and move referred to the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee.
Representative Cornish moves his bill to Transportation and Finance.
Okay, members, basically House File 12 is a very simple bill in structure, but it's a very important bill, I think you'll soon find out. What House File 12 does is establish a blue alert system. The blue alert system basically, in layman's terms, is a system where they have a notification if a cop has been seriously injured or critically injured. That'll be wording that we'll come up with probably by the end of the two committees. But if you've been seriously injured or killed, a notification would go out on electronic media and crime alerts, things like this. Now, I'm not as good as explaining this as our person will be from the Department of Public Safety, who will be up here later, but what this bill does is use the current Amber Alert system for abduction of children, something how we've been using it in the past. It'll use the current system, and the fiscal note was asked for, and it was received, and it came back officially zero cost. And whatever small minimal cost would be absorbed by the organizations. So the bill doesn't cost us anything. It uses the existing network, and just for a quick, for instance, if a cop, he or she was seriously injured or killed, then the Amber Alert system would be used to notify the public. And The DPS person will explain this more and how the system works and the input they'll take and the rules that they'll prescribe for the use of this thing, such as, you know, what is seriously injured or what is critically injured and how the notification will go out. So rather than take questions now, if you don't mind, I would like I think I would rather have the a survivor come up and testify first, Susan Merrily, and then after she's done, maybe have the DPS to explain how it would work. So I'll have my testifier come up.
Could you please state your name for the record?
Yes, I'm Susan Merrily, and I'm president of the state chapter of Concerns of Police Survivors. So as a survivor, I run a nonprofit organization that assists in resources and peer support for our families that have lost loved ones in the state of Minnesota. And I am also a survivor. I've been part of this organization for the past year and have met a lot of the survivors, the Patricks, the Schneiders, the Deckers. And I can tell you that every time a law enforcement officer goes down, if he's shot in the line of duty or if he's injured, as a survivor, your heart sinks and you're glued to the news. And all you care about is those families and what they're going through. And I had a chance to go out to the candlelight vigil the night that Officer Patrick went down, and the community, the support, and the concern that this perpetrator was still out on the loose and really not knowing much about him. So I think putting this blue alert system in place will put many people at ease and also hopefully deter that person from killing another officer or another civilian. So Concerns of Police Survivors does support this blue alert system. Thank you.
Any questions at this time? Thank you.
And then I, hopefully my Department of Public Safety person.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Janelle Rasmussen. I am the Minnesota Amber Alert Coordinator at the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And Representative Cornish asked that I talk briefly about the Amber Alert plan and the technology that we use in the state of Minnesota to activate an Amber Alert here, which has been a very successful program, not only Minnesota, but throughout. The Amber Alert system, when we activate it, utilizes the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, the Emergency Alert System, social media, the Department of Transportation, road signs. We do it through WEA, which is the Wireless Emergency Alert Network, so all cell phones are being activated. And we're able to do that very quickly and rapidly to get the information out about an abducted child whose life is in danger. The Minnesota Crime Alert Network is something that's unique to Minnesota and now Wisconsin, and that's a system where we're able to send out alerts through broadcast technology. We send alerts out through that system by fax, email, and text messages. So when we have any sort of a crime in Minnesota, local law enforcement agencies are trained on how to send these alerts out. And we put this information out to the entire state of Minnesota in a matter of just a couple of minutes. So it's a very effective technology that we have available and that would integrate well with the Blue Alert as well. So we're able to do that in just a matter of a couple of minutes and get accurate, timely information out to not only law enforcement, the media, but also to businesses and organizations as well. We have about 15,000 businesses and associations that are in the Crime Alert Network. So when we're sending this information out, like I said, it not only goes to the media where they can rebroadcast it, but it goes to law enforcement and then all of these other partners as well. So gas stations, grocery stores, hospitals, schools, everybody will receive this information immediately as it is issued.
One thing that I forgot to mention, Mr. Chair and members, was the one of the reasons is probably about 1975 was the first time I ever heard when I was a policeman in Amboy, Minnesota, when an officer got shot. And of course, then there was really no electronic messaging system. And since then, we've sat, as probably Officer Johnson and Schoen here have, in the squad car and heard countless number of times these officers either get seriously assaulted or killed. And the system is improving, but this would be one more to put eyes and ears out there to look for them, because many times after the assault has taken place or the death, these people escape in a vehicle, and so this system would really be helpful in apprehension, a quicker apprehension, before these people get out into the general public and do more damage. I'm glad to answer any questions if there are any.
Representative Bertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the Amber Alert, the Blue Alert, if implemented, is two systems we hope we don't have to use very often. But I recently flew out to Washington, and in getting in a rental car and driving to my hotel, I noticed the over the highway there was Amber Alert on the electronic reader system. And by the time I got checked into the hotel, with the aid of all these eyes and ears in the public, on the TV, on the news, that individual had been located already. I was wondering if you had any data. I'm not sure how many times we implement the Amber Alert system, and would the Blue Alert system statistically probably be utilized more than the Amber Alert system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, the Amber Alert system, since we began the program here in Minnesota in 2001, has been activated 28 times, and we have recovered successfully 28 children.
Thank you.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I just was wondering if there's any concerns at all about overtaxing the system. I think somewhere along the line I had heard they were talking about doing it with senior citizens also. Are there any concerns along those lines?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, we do have a very defined set of criteria for Amber Alert in Minnesota, so we follow that criteria very strictly and work closely with local law enforcement agencies, and we've been very fortunate to follow that very carefully and not activate Amber Alerts for cases that do not meet that criteria. So we have activated it very rarely in Minnesota. For instance, last year we had zero activations of the system, but it is a concern in other states, and I am familiar with that as well.
And then I might add, too, that we're going to look at the bill. It's going to move to transportation. There's a couple of amendments we're considering. One is possibly changing seriously to critically, but maybe we'll leave that up to the DPS when they talk to the different law enforcement agencies and groups. And then the other change might be, as there is a couple of groups, advisory groups, that represent some PSAPs, these dispatchers around. They wanted to be included in the area of the bill that you see where they're going to ask for input. And I've talked to DPS, and they said that that would be no problem to include another group in there if they would like to be. So that's a couple of the things we're thinking about as the bill moves forward.
Representative Schoen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Corners, for getting this started. And I think, of course, I'm just going to have comments. I don't have questions because you know I support it, and I'm going to be on the bill. But what I want the public to understand is that we value all lives, and we think that the citizens' and police officers' lives are equally valuable, but those of us that have put on the uniform and our families that have watched us leave the door and know what could happen every day. And the reality is, the reason even more so, not just for the officers involved, but the families and the public safety to put this measure into place, a person that takes an officer's life has really committed themselves to an act that is irreversible, and there is virtually no hope left. And these are not people that we want roaming our streets, going into our schools, or having any opportunity to have any more freedom than they do for their last seconds of freedom. And so this is a good bill, because by the time that we're ready to publicly announce who they are, which hopefully in some circumstances are pretty quick, or who we want to find, the day that Officer Patrick was gunned down, I was working and was there. And the minute that we knew who that suspect was, we wanted to get that out as quickly as possible. And we still had difficulties in between agencies and just getting the NCIC alert so that we could attempt to locate to all the counties. And even with our radio systems that are interoperable, it's still some bit of cumbersome activity. And that could be up to an hour later. And now we want people looking out their windows. We want people looking at each other when they're going down the interstate. And we need the public to be a part of that. Because when we lose an officer, we lose a little bit of our freedom in this country, and we lose what's our binding fabric of safety.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am in support of this bill, and the question I would have, Representative Cornish, several times in the last year or two, I've received severe weather alerts, and I think it was one or two Amber alerts on my mobile phone, and I want to know if the this bill would also utilize a mobile technology, and if so, how is that utilized? Who makes that decision, and how is that pushed out to a geographic area?
Representative Lucero, or Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, if you don't mind, I'll let my testifier answer that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, that technology on your phone is through the wireless emergency alert. It's part of the IPAWS system, so that's coming from a federal level. And they have three different alerts that are activated on your phone. The first is a presidential alert, and that is something that you automatically have on your phone if it's WIA capable. The second is a Amber alert. That's an alert that is automatically on your phone. However, you can opt out. However, we highly encourage you not to. And then the third is a weather alert, which you can opt into. So those are the alerts that come through that IPAWS federal technology. Then at the state level, through the Minnesota Crime Alert Network, we have, if you're a subscriber of the network, you can receive alerts like Amber alerts through your text messaging as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, and so would this alert be incorporated in that technology to be able to utilize mobile devices?
Chair Johnson, Representative Lucero, it would be at the state level. However, at the federal level, it would not be at this time. They are currently, I understand, working on legislation there as well to incorporate other alerts into that system and that technology.
Representative Clump.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just trying to get some clarification on this bill. There are fortunately very few occurrences, and I was wondering why, at least in my area, other first responders are dispatched through the same LEC system as law enforcement, you know, fire, first responders, etc. And because, again, it's rare, but it does happen that where people will set a fire or place a bomb or do something and then wait for the responders to show, whether they be law enforcement, fire, or EMT and first responders, and then they're added to the casualties of the situation. Is there, if there was a in line of duty casualty of another first responder, is there any consideration of having them included? Because if they're going after any dispatched first responder, they will go after, you know, law enforcement and others, just as was mentioned. These are not nice people, and the sooner we get them, the better.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, if you're asking if first responders or anybody else on the front line is being considered in this bill other than peace officers, the answer is no, not at this time.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would hope you would look at that possibility because, again, you know, at least in my part of the state, they're dispatched in the same manner to similar and often the same, you know, occurrences. And in line of duty, I think would be a reasonable. And, again, hopefully things are rare and get rarer. But, again, we're here because bad things happen to good people.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my comment is representative of an area that recently had one of these. I think it would have been a great asset to have that. But my question to you, where else is this being used in the country, and how effective has it been?
I believe you answered the question. My testifier maybe is how many states. I think I had heard 22 from my other testifier, something like that. Maybe you can verify it.
Chair Johnson, Representative, the last I checked on the national blue alert system, there were 20 states that had a formalized statewide plan for blue alert.
Representative Newbert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Cornish, for bringing this bill forward. I, too, support this, and I think it's a good idea. I'm building a little bit on Representative Quam's remarks. As an EMS provider, it's exceedingly dangerous at times, especially for firefighters, first responders. When we're on the side of the road, we average the statistics here. There are about 13 EMS line of duty deaths every year. My question would be, would build on this, would be in the case of a hit and run where we have firefighters or EMS workers who get struck by cars that don't slow down or don't merge over, and they're killed or critically wounded, as these, if you have these drivers who do this, who take off, I think that this would be a great opportunity to include these first responders as well, and paramedics. There's a really good case up in Clearwater on 94 where we had a firefighter who got hit. I know the man in this case, and the injuries were lifelong and life changing. So I would just ask that maybe we could have a discussion offline, possibly about being open to that, where we have an EMS firefighter, paramedic, first responder. If we have a hit and run type of case, where that would be included in this part of the equation. But as we stand right now, as the bill currently reads, I think this is a good bill. I think it's a good idea, and I look forward to voting yes on it. I just would like to encourage you to be open to building on it a little bit to include all of the people that respond.
Mr. Chair, members, I would be interested in looking at it, but I refer back to Representative Constantine's questions. If we start doing that, then the EMS ambulance personnel would naturally have a liking to be on it, but then we're going to have to look at MnDOT workers and how many of them are killed on the side of the road by the cones and things that get run over, and it's, the more we put on it, I worry about the frequency that the Amber Alert system is used, and therefore taking away from the unique once in a great while thing. But I'll sure talk about with you offline, you bet.
Any other further questions? Representative Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Cornish. And I'm not sure who, just in terms of the connection with the other districts, the other states that are using a blue alert system, those of us who live close to the borders, and if there were such an incident, I'm assuming that you would also be coordinating with neighboring states, because people don't necessarily try to disappear into the metropolitan area and get lost there. They might be trying to cross state lines. So is there some thought of coordinating with other states and expanding this so that it doesn't necessarily have to be a national program, but at least coordinating with other states who are using the Blue Alert and maybe encouraging our neighboring states to do that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can tell you that with the Amber Alert plan, we do coordinate with all of the other states and work very closely together. And so we're able to activate, for instance, in Wisconsin, if we have a child who's taken across the border, we work closely with our partners there. And each state has an Amber Alert coordinator, and we are aware of the criteria in our neighboring states and the national criteria, so we're able to activate. In fact, Minnesota's was the first state to have an interstate activation, where we had a child taken from St. Cloud to Utah, and we activated their plan there, and then they were able to successfully recover that child for us. So we do work closely with our neighboring states as well.
Representative Ward.
I guess my question was more about the neighboring states and their use of the Blue Alert. I'm really, really grateful for the work that Amber Alert has done nationwide, but how are we going to move this forward for the Blue Alert?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not familiar with the neighboring states' Blue Alert criteria, procedures, or programs, but I think that if we were to have Blue Alert in Minnesota, that's something we could definitely work on, is working with our neighboring states.
Representative Sean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Rasmussen, that couple of questions around here sparked something for me. Do any other states have this titled as maybe a public safety officer that would include paramedics, firefighters, and police officers that you know of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Schoen, I am not familiar with other states' criteria or procedures.
Thank you.
Anyone from the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Okay, just Representative Cornish, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I myself have been in the situation not once but twice where I've had either coffee or dinner with an officer in the evening, and we're looking for the person who took his life later that night. Getting this information out to the public with the proper information and the criteria that's being set up, I believe, is a very good thing. Not only get in order to help to apprehend the suspect, but also for the safety of their of this people of this state. By using that, similar to the AMLR alert system, if it happens in the daytime, we can instantly get the schools in the area locked down to protect the children. I think this is a good thing, and I want to thank you again for bringing this forward. Representative Cornish, you want to renew your motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to renew my motion. First, I'd like to thank my testifiers for coming up here today and helping me out. And I'd like to renew my motion that House File 12 be recommended to pass and move to the Transportation Policy and Finance Committee.
Representative Cornish renews his motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Should have warned the judiciary that next we're going to have John Wolfe, our fiscal analyst, run through the budget for us, going to skim over it and give us some a little more details than we had before. Mr. Wolfe.
Mr. Chair and members, in your packets you'll find a copy of the spreadsheet that outlines the governor's budget. I'm not going to go through in great detail today. You'll have an opportunity to discuss each agencies' budget requests when they come forward before the committee, but this is just to familiarize you with the spreadsheet document that you'll be seeing probably several times this session. In your packets, you should have a spreadsheet that looks like this. Many of you who've been around are familiar with spreadsheets that are similar for different areas of the budget. For those of you that may be freshman members or new to the committee, it's divided up by agency. For example, on line one of the spreadsheet, you'll see the Supreme Court is listed. And the way you read these is the top line will be their base budget or what they're carrying forward into this biennium. Below that, you'll see the decision items or what the governor is recommending that they receive in addition to that base, and then the total or subtotal below. So, Mr. Chair, I'll just start with the Supreme Court on page one. The Supreme Court has one major initiative that in the budget book is entitled Maintain Core Justice Operations, but that is split into three separate items within that. There's a supplement for employee compensation. They're seeking 5% and 5% for employees, as well as judges below that, and insurance cost increases, mainly for health insurance. And in any line that you say you see insurance increases, there may be other small ancillary items that the agency is requesting. It may include a small amount for a rental increase or something of that nature. Below that, you'll see a line for civil legal services. There wasn't much information in the budget book about that, but they just a general increase for some expanded service of $1 million a year.
Mr. Wall? Sorry for the interruption, but I just want to let the members know this is just a run through the budget, so I'd rather wait with questions when we get each department or organization up in front of us instead of asking them now. And this is just kind of an overview of our budget sheet and familiarize you with it and its structure. So go ahead, Mr. Wells.
Mr. Chair, continuing on, for the Court of Appeals, they also have a maintain court justice operations request that includes employee compensation, judge compensation, and insurance increases. Moving down to the district courts, they have, again, a similar request for employee and judge compensation and insurance increases. There's also a request for additional jury compensation, and you'll see that's noted as a mileage increase from 27 cents a mile to 56 cents a mile, and the juror per diem increase from $10 a day to $20 a day. And the amounts in fiscal year 16 and 17 to fund those. The Guardian Ad Litem Board is requesting a budget shortfall amount of $1 million a year plus compensation increases as well. The Tax Court is requesting a new case management system. They also have a request for salaries, insurance, and other fixed expenses, and for one additional law clerk. And members, you may note if you see a number in parentheses after a decision item, that is for additional state FTEs or state positions, and so the additional law clerk is denoted as one position. The Uniform Laws Commission at the bottom of the first page is requesting a very small amount for increased dues and travel costs. Moving on to page 2, the Board of Judicial Standards is looking for a half an FTE for additional part-time staff. The Public Defense Board is requesting additional staff for caseload reduction, and that would be a total of 41 additional attorneys, as well as compensation and insurance increases as well. Mr. Chair, moving to the Department of Public Safety, their Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management is looking for two FTEs for a state-only disaster records management system, and they also have a small request for salaries and insurance for that part of the agency. Moving down to the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, they had a large request for additional resources, but that is split into many separate areas, five latent fingerprint examiners, two mitochondrial DNA analysts, $800,000 a year for additional equipment replacement, $350,000 a year for supplies, a new digital forensics unit, which would be nine FTEs, a financial crimes unit, which would be five additional employees, a predatory crimes section, which would be 13 employees, and then they had a request to replace all live scan machines statewide. At $1.3 million a year, there's about 175 of these machines statewide, and they would replace several of these on an annual and ongoing basis. Again, there's a request for salaries and insurance. Moving down to the fire marshal, additional dollars for salaries and insurance. Gambling enforcement, there is a request for salaries and insurance, but they also have a request for enforcement reduction. There was not as much gambling activity related to the stadium bill as had been anticipated, and they're just requesting that they reduce the amount of enforcement they requested because there's not as much activity as they anticipated. Moving to the Office of Justice Programs, there's a small amount requested for salaries and insurance. Emergency Communication Network is requesting a spending authority increase. This breaks down to an operating increase for the department itself, some next-gen 911 initiatives, which would include additional equipment and additional grants to local governments. There's a small amount of additional salary insurance money for that section of the department, which would complete all the requests for the Department of Public Safety. The Post Board has a small amount for salary and insurance, as well as the Private Detectives Board. Moving down to the Department of Corrections, Department of Corrections has several FTEs in their request. They have maintained their core operations, but included in that is a salary and insurance request to keep all their guard positions and other employees funded for the contract that was agreed to. But they also have a request to switch any of the contracted kitchen workers to state employees, and that would bring 74 employees under state contracts instead of being external workers. They have a request for offender health care service increase. This would be for employees to maintain electronic health records and put 24-hour nursing coverage at three additional facilities. They have this 24-hour nursing coverage at two facilities currently. This would be to expand to three more, and that would be an additional 19 FTEs. They want to increase their fugitive apprehension unit. That would be five additional employees. Under the community services, there's a small amount for salaries and insurance, but they also are requesting additional money to community supervision. There's an intensive supervised release. This would be 10 new agents, but seven would be at the county level. Three would be at the Department of Corrections. A challenge incarceration supervision increase of 2.5 employees, and then they would add $1.5 million a year to the Community Corrections Act formula and $200,000 a year to the county probation officer formula. Those are both additions of 4% over their current levels. Mr. Chair, moving on to the final page, in operation support for the Department of Corrections, there's a request for additional salaries and insurance money, as well as 11 IT positions for what the department calls IT modernization. And Mr. Chair, the last agency is the Department of Sentencing Guidelines, and there is an unlabeled item, which is salaries and insurance at a few thousand dollars a year. And Mr. Chair, those are the, in a very brief, the governor's requests for the agencies before us.
Thank you. Representative Kronk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line item 211, it was stated in the presentation 19 for the expansion of the 24-7. Where are the additional 4.5? My sheet shows 23.5.
Oh, Mr. Chair, Representative Palm, I'm reading off of a spreadsheet I had made some changes to after discussing things lining up better with the Senate fiscal analyst. The total for the request, which was additional health services, was 23.5 new employees. Four of those were to maintain the electronic health records. The remaining 19.5 would be for nursing staff at the three facilities. And that's just something I need to clarify in the spreadsheet.
Representative
Pop. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, it would be useful if we had the up to date that matches when they're presenting, just for future reference.
Thank you. Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the community services, the challenge incarceration supervision, I was under the impression that was in the institutions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, I believe that's correct.
But it's listed under community services.
Well, community supervision is a part of the department that has state-funded probation officers and county-funded as a pass-through. And so there's the money for the formulas for the CCA and the CPO counties go through there. There are some counties that are all all the probation work is done by the DOC, and so money flows through that part of the agency for both state employees and county employees, and those 2.5 positions are for state employees.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we'll move on to the judicial branch presentation. I want to thank you for coming here. If you could please state your names for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Shorba. I am the State Court Administrator for the Judicial Branch, and I'm joined this morning to assist in my presentation by Judge Kevin Mark, who's the President of the Minnesota District Judges Association. I'm here this morning to review the Judicial Branch budget and provide an overview of our fiscal year 16-17 biennial budget request, which you just heard a little bit about from Mr. Wald. Let me begin just with an overview of the court's budget. The judicial branch budget is appropriated by the legislature to the three levels of courts, and our fiscal year 14-15 biennial budget is shown on this slide. In total, funding for the judicial branch of Minnesota state government totals less than 2% of the general fund budget for the overall state. The judicial branch is also allocated funds, as you see in the bottom here, for civil legal services programs. For fiscal year 14-15, that amount was a little over $24 million, and we just passed those through to civil legal services as a grant program. The trial courts is, of course, our largest budget in the judiciary and is broken down into five categories. The 10 judicial district budgets, and those budgets fund the trial court employees and our operations in 100 locations across the state. Salaries and benefits for our 289 trial court judges is the second category. The third is what we call central accounts, and it includes things like overhead for workers' comp, unemployment, et cetera. Drug courts amounts to about $9 million over the biennium. The state appropriation provides funding for 26 of our 50 drug courts, and the rest are funded through grants from both the federal and state government. And then the last category you see on here is what we call mandated services, and those are services that we provide according to statute in areas such as jury, psychological exams, interpreter services across the state in that category. Court of Appeals is much more streamlined, really just funding for staff salaries, judge salaries, and operating expenses in the Court of Appeals. And then finally, the last category is for the Supreme Court. There are five primary functions funded in that budget. Supreme Court operations, which include the salaries of the justices and Supreme Court staff. My office, the Office of the State Court Administrator, we really provide the central infrastructure for the courts as a whole. A large part of this budget is central funding for technology, but also finance, human resources functions, et cetera. The state law library is included in this budget. We have a separate line item for child support magistrates. We budget 34% of the cost, and the federal government pays 66% of the cost for child support functions. And then there's a small pass-through grant program authorized by the legislature for community dispute resolution grants to nonprofits who mediate small neighborhood disputes across the state. When I spoke to this committee a couple of weeks ago, I spent a significant amount of my time sharing with you some of the highlights of our ambitious innovation agenda at the judicial branch. I'm not going to repeat all the work being done across the branch, but we are very proud of our accomplishments of our judges and employees who are driving this important work to modernize our court system. This work was recently recognized by the Humphrey School of Public Affairs, which presented the judicial branch with its 2014 State Government Innovation Award for our e-court agenda. I want to remind you of this work because it ties directly into our budget request. We are here to present today a request that really is driven by our staff and our judges who are tackling new challenges, assuming a greater workload, and trying to innovate within our branch. While we've been moving forward through our innovation agenda, unfortunately, compensation for our people has fallen further and further behind, which is what brings me to our fiscal year 16 and 17 budget request. After careful consideration of several initiatives, the Judicial Council concluded that the branch budget request would concentrate in three key areas. Maintaining the caliber of employees and judges necessary to continue to drive innovation in our court system and improve service to the public. Restoring cuts to juror per diem and mileage that were made during difficult budget shortfalls. And then holding our court services harmless from what we anticipate will be insurance cost increases, which I'll talk about in a minute. Our request totals about $45 million. And I'm going to talk briefly about the employee compensation part and then turn it over to Judge Mark to talk about judge compensation. The first portion of our request is to increase employee compensation. As Mr. Wall said, the request asks for a 5% increase in each year of the biennium. We're asking for this increase because during the height of the recession, we were forced to impose a multi-year salary freeze in order to preserve essential court functions. Employees did not receive ongoing permanent compensation increases between fiscal year 08 and fiscal year 13. At times, during that freeze, other parts of state government and local government were providing compensation increases to their employees. We did, during this biennium, receive from the legislature funding to provide increases in fiscal year 14 and 15, and we really appreciate the legislature's support that allowed us to end our salary freeze. But it did not fix the major structural issues in the judicial branch's pay structure resulting from that multi-year pay freeze. The challenges include below-market salary structure as compared with other public sector employees who continued to provide increases while we did not. This summer, we had an independent analysis of our salary structure, which showed that we were consistently below market compared to other state and local government entities. We've had difficulty attracting and retaining qualified staff for key positions. And just like other parts of government, we are experiencing a retirement wave. During the next 10 years, 30% of judicial branch staff will be 65 years of age or older. And so we want to be able to attract and retain individuals as we are going through that retirement wave. We've tried to tackle this problem as much as we could internally, but we really feel that we need the help of the legislature with some funding to take the important next step to increase our salary structure and remain competitive with other government entities.
Mr. Shorba?
Mr. Chair?
With the five-year salary freeze from 08 to 13, what was the increase in the 14-15 budget?
3% each year.
Thank you.
I'll now turn it over to Judge Mark to talk a little bit about the judge request.
Representative Pilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry I was up there, so I didn't have the opportunity to partially answer as the former chair of the committee. I just wanted to make it clear that we gave judge pay raises 4% in the first year, 3% in the second, and we fixed their pension issue as well. So when they're talking about this, we did give additional dollars to fix that last year.
Thank you.
Or the year before.
Mr. Chair. And members of the committee, good morning. My name is Kevin Mark. I'm the president of the Minnesota District Judges Association. With me today is the Honorable Tracy Warner, Chief Judge of the 2nd District here in Ramsey County. She's the vice president of the association. Our association is comprised of nearly all of the district judges, that is the trial court bench, as well as members of the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. And we're here today to talk to you about the judicial budget request and more specifically the compensation piece. In that regard, I would ask you to consider it not just as a pay raise, but more of an investment in the infrastructure of the judicial branch or a payment on the maintenance of that infrastructure. And to do that, let me start by first talking a little bit about what I do as a district judge. I'm a judge in Red Wing. It's Goodhue County. We have three judges in that courthouse, so I basically do one-third of the cases that come through the door, everything that comes through the door. And I contrast that with judges in the urban, more large courthouses who frequently will be on a rotation or an assignment where they will take maybe major criminal, major civil, family, or juvenile on an extended rotation or period of time and specialize in that area. That's not true for most of the judges that I'm here to speak on behalf of today. In Red Wing, I handle, again, anything that comes through the door. And to offer you an example, there's been talk this morning about the Brian Fitch case, which is concluding up in Stearns County, actually has concluded up there and will now return for sentence in Dakota County. My colleague and friend Mary Tyson, a judge in the First District, has been presiding over that very difficult case and bringing it to its conclusion. When Judge Tyson completes that case and gets back to her regular routine, she could be sent down to Red Wing or over to Shakopee or Apple Valley, and next week be hearing a case on juvenile truancy or maybe a carpet damage claimed by a landlord in conciliation court. Or she might be getting a motion for summary judgment in some business contract or requesting an injunction and interference with a violation of an employment contract. She could be seeing a personal injury matter. She could be seeing almost anything, and that's what you have with most of the outstate judges, nearly all of the outstate judges. We hear and decide everything. Now, if you're familiar at all with legal practice, you know that attorneys would never dare try to cover all those various subject matters, and their malpractice insurers wouldn't allow it. But as judges, we don't have that choice. It is necessary for us to hear everything that comes in the door and to hopefully provide a correct answer, a correct ruling in the end. What we need in order for our judiciary, our judicial branch, to continue to succeed is to attract and draw attorneys, people in the legal profession, to the judiciary who aren't just experienced in criminal matters, public defender matters, but have this wide range of experience. We need judges who are experienced in business matters, who can read contracts, who understand real estate law or personal injury law, insurance law, probate law, and all these different sectors of the law, because if we don't, we're going to suffer. And here's why. In order for me to understand all these various cases, I can stay up late and read, I can get up in the morning, but sometimes those cases that you haven't seen before, that particular subject matter, is just something you need to ask somebody else. And our best source of information are our fellow judges. And thank goodness for email. That's the best thing you do when you're faced with one of those challenging questions that you just don't have the time to say, hey, everybody, just wait here. I need to go look up something. Is you email other judges in the district and say, hey, here's what I've got. Can you give me some direction and where I go with it? We teach each other. And we draw upon the broad expertise of other judges on the district bench. We do it informally that way by phone, a walk down the hallway to talk to another judge. But we also do it formally when we have our conferences. Almost all of our breakout sessions, our seminars, are taught by our other judges, judges that have the expertise in that particular area. And again, this is why we need to continue to attract attorneys from all over the legal spectrum to the judiciary so that we can benefit from their expertise. Mr. Shorba has talked about the specialty courts, and I'm sure you're familiar with them as well. We can pride ourselves in Minnesota. We're an innovator in specialty courts, veterans courts, drug courts, DWI courts, mental illness courts. If you peel back the history of a lot of those courts, they're spearheaded by judges who have some particular background or experience, and a judge or a series of judges pull together and say, we can deal better with this particular type of defendant in a special court, and then it goes from there. And then there's this technology piece. Right now, or for the past year, 2 years, the judiciary is undergoing probably the most major transformation since its beginning. That being to go from a paper-based operation to an electronic one. It is like the proverbial prop airplane that is being transformed into a jet with passengers in the air. We can't take a time out. We've got to keep going, but we're making this transformation. And we, again, draw upon the talent and the expertise of some new judges who come in with a technological background that I didn't have and a lot of my colleagues didn't have. And by the way, there's been a few early retirements during this process. But they bring that to the bench, and we all benefit from it. Now, these are matters that internally are going on from my perspective. Let me give you a couple other very interesting perspectives about how our court system is doing. The National Center for Access to Justice is a nonprofit organization in Cardoza Law School in New York. What they do is they rank court systems on their ability to grant access to all members of society to their justice system. And they're particularly interested with the disenfranchised, the minorities, those facing various barriers to the court system. At one point last year, 2014, Minnesota was ranked number one by that organization. In their most recent rankings, we're now number three, but we're in the top five across the country. Now, contrast that with the other one I have on this slide, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And we all know they have a little different interest level. They're interested in their business organizations. But yet, that organization, the Chamber, recognized Minnesota as fourth best in the country as to its friendliness to the litigants that enter into their environment, into that court system. We're still ranked number five by these two very divergent angles. So we think that we're doing pretty well in that regard. But we always need to do better. It's something that we can't do, we can't continue without a regular investment. Let me talk specifically about the confirmation piece. Of the compensation piece, excuse me. In the 90s, compensation for judges in Minnesota had fallen to in or near the bottom third across the country. And Dr. Carl Egge, who's a professor or was a professor of economics at McAllister, undertook a study, and he concluded that judges in Minnesota were undercompensated by about 20% as compared to judges across the country, but also as to various other positions in the state of Minnesota. And as a result, or at least in part as a result of his study, there was a 6.5% raise in 2001 and 2002 for the judges. And as you can see on this slide, there was at that time a rise in the rankings from 30 up to about 22nd. And in fact, in the 3 years that followed, we ranked as high as 18 in the country. Now, that's not the highest that Minnesota judges have ranked. Going back to 1980, you'll see they're actually in the top 10 across the country. But we had reached 18th. But then, as Mr. Schorber alluded, over the course of time since then, with some pay freezes and the like, we have gotten back down to where we are now in the 30s. And acknowledging the raise that was received in the last biennium, other states obviously did the same. And so we still are in that 31st ranking across the country. And as shown on this chart, the U.S. average is considerably higher than what Minnesota currently compensates its trial judges and appellate judges. Now, this is an external ranking. I want to give you an internal check or ranking as well. I mentioned my colleague, Judge Tyson, hearing the Fitch case. In that case, and this ties in again to something Mr. Schorba said, that other public groups, agencies, departments have continued to compensate their employees more than the judicial branch. While Judge Tyson had the ultimate responsibility for providing a fair trial to Mr. Fitch and also obviously to the family members of the officer who was slain, the prosecutor in that case is an assistant county attorney for Dakota County, and obviously he did a very good job. His compensation is considerably more than the judge that heard the case. And I suggest to you that that model is out of whack, where the litigators publicly financed earn more than the judge that has the ultimate responsibilities in that case. Dr. Corrine Moe is a successor to Dr. Egge at McAllister College. She undertook, or kind of picked up the ball from Dr. Egge and provided a report to the legislature 2 years ago. She updated that in 2014 in July of last year, and that's where the 5% raise recommendation derives. A 5% raise in her study concludes that this will bring judges back to the economic buying power they had in 2002. As far as our ranking, everything else being equal, it would bring us back up to a ranking of 25, basically right in the middle. I said earlier that I would ask you to consider this an investment in infrastructure. We all understand infrastructure. It's something that's there that we've bought and paid for. But we also know that if it's ignored over time, it can deteriorate. The catch-up costs can be considerable. Sometimes there can be disastrous consequences. And that's what I'm asking you to try to avoid when it comes to the infrastructure that is the judicial branch. And again, as Mr. Shorba said, and I have this experience that you have as an elected representative. I served 17 and a half years on the Red Wing School Board before I came to the bench. And for many of those years, we had flat or declining enrollment. And you know what that means. You have to make budget cuts. And so setting priorities was always a difficult thing on an annual basis. But we knew, as you know, that buildings, computers, software, all these things are nice and beneficial, but it's the people that actually make things work or they don't. And it's that investment that I'm asking you to make. I want to finish with one anecdote that I think shows where the rubber hits the road. At the end of last year, 2014, in the 9th Judicial District, which is the northwest part of the state, has 17 counties in the 9th District, and there was a judge opening. Applications open, applications closed. There were 3 applicants for that position. There were 32 applicants for the position that I sought, and I would guess that probably something in the teens is the norm that the Judicial Selection Commission is used to working with, but they only had 3. So they contacted Chief Judge Kurt Marbin up in the 9th and said, can you maybe find some more applicants? And he made 3 contacts, and I had this conversation with him about 2 weeks ago. He called 3 different lawyers that he thought would make good applicants, good candidates for the position. All 3 declined, and they gave us their reason. Their number one reason was the compensation. We need to attract talented people to the bench, and I would ask you to make that investment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any questions at this point? Members, you've got budget books in front of you with more detail if something perks your interest out of those books. You can also ask that to Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that very good presentation. Maybe being a judge gives you that talent to do just that. Do you have an idea or a perception of workload between criminal cases and civil cases?
Judge?
Mr. Chair, you mean in terms of percentages of the types of cases?
Yeah.
The criminal cases on a real basis preoccupy most of your time and schedule. Civil, including family, probably balances out, but civil in terms of civil litigation business is less than what we see of criminal cases.
Okay. Representative Hertaus?
Well, thank you. And I guess the only comment I would make, and I'm not making judgment as to whether or not more resources are justified, but of lately we see that Minnesota, since its statehood, has really been on a trend or a pathway of passing more laws and criminalizing behavior. From statehood, we've gone from 71 statutory felony crimes to more than 370. In the beginning, there was no provision probation. Now we have a lot of probation. Minnesota has its, among the nation, one of the lowest incarceration rates, but on the other hand, has a very high probationary period. And so the fact that we do these stays of adjudication in favor of not incarcerating and having very elongated probations really, I think, over time probably is increasing recidivism rather than decreasing it. And so I would ask all of us as members to peer into that question whether or not we're creating the over-criminalization of our conduct in society and putting an unnecessary burden on not only the court system but for the members of our community.
Okay, Representative Quam, followed by Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the books, I'm seeing FTEs for the Court of Appeals and District Courts, and I was wondering if any of those FTEs are judgeships. And because I do know that there are certain areas that are are borrowing judges. So if we could get a little idea of what the FTDs are.
Judge or Mr. Shorba?
Don't, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, those are not judgeships, those are employees. Judgeships are in the budget books at a different place, and I can certainly clarify with Mr. Walls the FTE numbers if you'd like.
Okay, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. You had mentioned at some point coming retirements, and you also mentioned at one point early retirements. Is there a mandatory retirement age, and why are any particular trend in terms of why people are retiring early? Is that really related to the income as well?
Mr. Judge? Chair, Representative, my somewhat glib comment had to do with the challenges of some of the older judges to deal with the technology. I heard more than one comment about, oh my God, I think it's time for me to retire. But we have a mandatory retirement age of 70. I've been on the bench a dozen years. I haven't seen any real trend in that regard. I think it's probably comparable to what people now look at in any sector, that is, can they afford health insurance, other issues like that. But other than that, no, I don't see any particular trends.
Representative Hillsborough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Shorba, we've seen some early retirement payouts in some other areas of government. Has the court been doing any of those over the last 5 years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, we have not done early retirement payouts. We have tried to, as Judge Mark said, provide health insurance savings accounts for people who may want to retire, who need the health insurance. We are seeing, just like I mentioned, sort of the baby boomer generation in both judges and staff getting to the age of retirement, and that's why we're seeing a large number of both employees and judges retiring.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Sherber.
Mr. Chair, just two other quick areas for the budget requests that I mentioned, one being juror per diem and mileage. In 2014, 60,000, a little over 60,000 Minnesota citizens reported for jury duty. It's a foundational part of our justice system. Unfortunately, due to difficult budget situations, we reduced juror per diem twice since 2003 and have long frozen the rate of mileage increases. So this funding would allow us to increase the juror per diem back to its pre-2008 levels, and would allow an increase in mileage to what is the current federal IRS rate for mileage. The last portion of the budget request has to do with insurance. The judicial branch.
Shorba? Excuse me.
I can wait till the end.
Are you waiting until the end? Okay, go ahead, Mr. Shorba.
The judicial branch follows the same insurance plan negotiated by Minnesota Management and Budget, and they are estimating these increases in the employer share of insurance through 15 and 16 and 17. And so this part of our request asked for funding to absorb those insurance increases for the judicial branch. So that is the total of our increase. As you can see, it's really about our people, not only our staff and our judges, but our jurors who come to serve on our juries every day. We believe we are good stewards of the public dollar. We are innovating within our branch, trying to make better use of our resources and also to improve customer service, and we are hopeful that this request will allow us to maintain the caliber of staff and judges that we have within the judiciary. So I thank the committee for their consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Shorba. Before I get to Representative Hertaus, on the juror per diem and things, were any of them complaining about it in mass? Is that where you got it from, or was it just your folks' idea that they should be paid more?
Mr. Chair, I think it's a combination. We have heard some complaints from jurors. I mean, the current per diem is $10 a day, which is not very much. The highest it was $30. The mileage rate right now is, as you saw from Mr. Walls, 27 cents. It is a hardship, especially for those who do not get paid from their employer while they are serving juror duty. So people who are, you know, independent operators, they own their own business, do have a hardship. But also, we feel like it's a really important part of our system, and that's why the Judicial Council prioritizes it as one of our items. So it's a combination of the two.
Then another question. Historically, how have you folks been given raises? Have you ever, like some organizations like nursing homes in the past, been given a raise in a block, and then you decide what percentage goes to the judges and what goes to the staff? Or is it usually when you have received a raise that it must go for a certain percentage to the judges and per certain percentage to staff? You know the history of that?
Mr. Chair, the legislature decides what the increase will be for judges specifically. So the legislature determines what percentage increase the judges will get with the advice of the Compensation Council. So it's always specifically designated for judges. When we have gotten percentage increases from the legislature for staff, obviously we have to negotiate with our unions how we'll use that funding. So it's always been separated, staff and judges. It's never been one lump sum where we've decided that, the legislature has.
Okay, Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I, too, was going to make a comment where you were about the jury reimbursement rate. We probably all feel that it's a part of your civic responsibility to do your service and to serve on a jury. But I don't think it should be at a negative consequence. And for those who have ever served in the downtown metro area, like the Hennepin County court system, the per diem doesn't even cover the cost of your parking. It's impossible to park during the day, and you're actually going in the hole, not to mention that the mileage reimbursement rate is far below par as well. Not only do I support the idea that jurors should get a higher per diem, I think we could also help solve the problem by providing some form of a pass for anybody who serves as a juror to display in their car window. And maybe the city of Minneapolis wouldn't like this, but I think they should be able to park on the street for free while they're on jury duty. There ought to be an exemption to the parking laws for that. Thanks.
All right, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers. I was also going to comment on the expenses associated with this. I'm in Washington County, and I can park for free when I've been called for jury duty. And there is an ideal that it is a matter of public service and that we should all be able to respond accordingly. But I think that it often falls unfairly on some people to be when we're called for jury duty. Child care expenses, I agree. I think some kind of a parking pass when you are on jury duty or called to be waiting to be called, that seems to me like a really simple thing that we should be able to provide people parking. $10 a day doesn't cover the parking. It certainly doesn't cover child care. For those employees who are not able to be reimbursed for their expenses or are owners of company, it just falls unfairly across the spectrum of our citizens and people who perhaps would be more able to sustain those expenses are often those who are not going to be chosen by a jury or by the attorneys involved for a variety of reasons. So I would like to see if we could do something to kind of balance the playing field for citizens.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess my comments are going to go along these same lines. First off, I think it's really fantastic that you allow people to be on call. The thought of going down to the courthouse and sitting and waiting half a morning and not getting called to a case and then going back to half your day, I think is something that's rather difficult even for those first couple of times that you do that, until I recently served. But I also think about those individuals that, one, do you get many people waiving their per diem because they are being reimbursed by their employer for their time? Because quite frankly, we have a minimum wage in our state, and for individuals whose employers don't compensate them, they're losing incredible amount of income by serving on a jury. And to be quite honest, I don't think that makes them the best jury member that we would like them to be when it's a financial hardship for them to be sitting there and listening to the cases, and they're thinking about, well, my kids, you know, I've got to pay for child care, and, you know, my employer's not paying me. I mean, has there ever been any talk of totally restructuring how we compensate individuals who participate in the jury process?
Mr. Shorba.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean. We do get individuals who waive their per diem because they're getting paid by their employer. Obviously, we don't know if the employer is paying. The last time we did a survey was back in 99, which showed about 67% of jurors served at that time were compensated by their employer for jury duty. But that's the last time we did that survey. And we haven't looked at any other different ways of structuring besides a per diem right now. But that answers your question, I hope.
Mr. Chair?
Judge,
if I might respond as well, we get requests for jury waivers directed to the judge. The jury manager will bring up and say, I received this letter. And frequently that's the issue, is I don't get compensated, or I have child care and I can't possibly afford it. And I try to be very sympathetic, because obviously we can't have them as a productive juror if they're distracted. And that oftentimes gets covered by good trial lawyers as well. It's also the mark of a good trial judge to be very cognizant of the juror's time. That's something I learned over the years as a trial attorney, when the judge would make sure that time wasn't wasted with the jury sitting in the jury room, because that judge just respected their time, and that will, of course, bring them back, or they will talk to others that it was a really good experience. The other thing I've noticed in, again, just a dozen years, is that when there appears to be some type of national crisis or sense of patriotism, when we're active militarily overseas or post the Boston Marathon bombing, there seemed to be a greater turnout for jurors, and we had less trouble rounding them up. I think there's a sense of patriotism. And then when things get kind of quiet and everything seems good, then it gets a little harder. And as recently as last week, we didn't have enough jurors show up for a felony jury trial, and we had to make calls. We had to hold up the proceedings till we got enough people to show up.
Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up with a quick comment about that specifically. I think when we, you know, begin to consider those individuals whose income or hardships don't allow them to participate actively in the jury duty, and when judges excuse all of them, we've all of a sudden, at the same time, transform what the jury pool is. You know, when we take a sector of society, often low-income individuals, and we exclude them from being a jury member, we've now narrowed the pool, and we sort of impacted our judicial system by narrowing that pool. Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Considine, followed by, well, I guess Representative Considine. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does anybody tell me how public employees deal with this?
Deal with what?
Public employees, when they're called into jury duty, are they reimbursed by their employer, or are they taking a hit? I seem to remember 30 years ago being on jury duty, and there was some sort of a break where if I was there so long, I got reimbursed, but if it was a short period of time, I didn't. So just kind of curious as to what it is now.
I don't know. I've never been called, or I've never been submitted successfully through the screening process, I should say that. Maybe it's because of my insignia I wear, I don't know. But anybody know how public employees are reimbursed?
Do you folks know, Mr. Shorba?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that most public employers would compensate individuals. I have not heard that there's a major problem with public employers. I know the judicial branch compensates individuals who serve on jury duty. I haven't done a survey, but that's my impression.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If staff could review the statutes that might pertain to that, if there are any, that might be useful for us to look and review at leisure.
Yes, we can have one of our researchers look that up and see what statutes govern the payment of public employees during jury duty. All right. Any more questions? Representative Hertos and then Representative Johnson.
Well, while we're talking about it, it might be good data to know how many jury days are served in the court system. You know, how many people times how many days. Wonder what the cost would be if the per diem is raised.
Representative Johnson. Mr. Chair, reference to the public employees and if they're paid while they're on jury duty. I'm trying to remember the last time I looked at my last contract I looked at my former employer, was I Santa County. I'm trying to remember. I think there was something in the union contract that had that states whether we're paid if we're on jury duty or not.
Okay, any more questions? Are you folks done with your presentation?
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, if there's no more questions or concerns from our committee members, everybody must be happy. Representative Hilston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, are you asking that we leave our budget books here and you'll bring them back and forth, or are you asking that we take our budget books with us and bring them to committee?
Personally, I've always thought it's better to leave them here because so many members forget to bring them back with them, but it's up to you folks. But for me, I'd rather have them leave them here, and we don't have a lot of time to study them anyway, and when we take them home, it seems like.
It's all online, Mr. Chair.
You got a computer? All right. No more questions. Meeting adjourned till tomorrow.